weeknights from 6
on 2FM.
And a big thanks to Bette De Silva for driving us through the afternoon. It's Thursday, the 18th of July. You're listening to Game On here on 2FM with me, John Kenny. Coming up between now and 7 o'clock, we're live to Royal Troon in Scotland for the latest from day one at Golf's Open Championship. We'll also reflect on a big week for Irish women's football with Rebecca Creer. We'll also hear from Paris-bound Olympians Mona McSherry and Stacey Flood. And ahead of Ireland's first cricket test match in Stormont, we'll speak to the Irish captain, Andrew Balbirnie. As always, if you want to have your say, you can send us a text on 51552 or you can contact us on WhatsApp 087 187 9200.
Game on 2FM.
And you're very welcome. Rebecca Creer is in studio with us. We'll be talking to her very shortly about the 3-1 victory for the Republic of Ireland against France on Tuesday night. Great occasion. A pleasure to be there doing commentary on that game for Game On here on RT2FM. And also the disappointing news, I suppose, that the Ireland women's under-19s were beaten 2-1 by Germany in their second Group B game of the 2024 UEFA Women's European Championship. They're leading by a goal to nil at half-time, but Germany came through in the end. So now a big match of the weekend against the Dutch to try and get through to the second phase, the semi-finals as well. There's one match ongoing of note for us in the qualification for the conference, the UEFA Conference League. St. Joseph's against Shelburne kicked off at 5 o'clock and it's 1-1 there at half-time. Shelburne lead 2-1 from the first leg. So 3-2 on aggregate for Shells. They went behind on 25 minutes. Liam Walker, who's actually a Gibraltarian international, opened the scoring on 25, but Sam Bone equalised 9 minutes later. So 3-2 on aggregate at half-time. Derry City at 7:45 welcome Bruno Magpies of Gibraltar to the Brandywell, the second leg of their Conference League first qualifying round tie, having lost the first leg disappointingly 2-0. So a big, big mountain to climb there for them, and we will have Eric White giving us a preview of that particular game. But first, let's concentrate down on the golf. Shane Lowry and Rory McIlroy, well, completely opposite, juxtaposed positions at the end, coming towards the end of day one of the 152nd Open Golf Championship at Royal Troon. Gary Moran is there. Gary, as I say, contrasting days for both McIlroy and Lowry.
Oh, very much so, John. Alongside me, Greg Allen, who's been here since the crack of dawn. I only arrived kind of mid-morning, having just flown last night. And Greg, you were able to track Rory and indeed Tom McKibben, who was out at 6:45. They're long, long days here, nearly about four hours or so left.
Yeah, it is actually. I think the timesheet has a tee-off time at 6:30 in the morning, and the last one is 4:30 in the afternoon. A long day, but it's always alleviated in terms of whatever tedium can happen during a first day of an Open by the side of an Irishman at top of the leaderboard. Shane Lowry, 3 under par after 10 holes. This is the first time since 2019 that Shane Lowry has had a chance of being under par in the first round of the Open, and clearly to be 3 under after 10 on a course that's playing tough, tied for the lead on 3 under is a modest enough total, does show that Lowry has got something going again, and he has had something going all season. Statistically, it's been his best PGA Tour season in history right up to this point of the summer. We also know, of course, that back in 2019 he won on the DP World Tour in the Abu Dhabi Championship and won the Open around this week. So it's a sort of an almost a good omen type of picture. But let's go through first that round of Lowry. What's happened so far today? Par the first three holes, birdied the fourth hole from around 10 feet. And I was saying to you at the time, Gary, that the way he's putting in a certain way on links greens. He just gets links greens, and sometimes that putter flows. And so it flowed. Another putt of a similar length with a good 2-3 inches of break left to right, beautifully judged, dead centre on the seventh. On the eighth hole, the famous postage stamp, the shortest hole in Open Championship history, apparently at 118 yards. He hit this beautifully floated, flopped wedge with that beautiful soft hand approach that he has to the game. A real natural flow of a swing, and the ball rested about 8 feet beneath the hole, and in went the putt. And then on the ninth in a bit of trouble, just off the green, chips up to 7 feet, holds the putt to get out in 33. And then on the 10th, now from the 10th to the 13th, this is statistically the toughest part of the golf course, and he got into trouble on 10 and holed a 23-foot putt to save par there. So Lowry now playing the very difficult 495-yard par 411th hole on the right-hand side of the fairway with an iron in his hands and sending a shot up into the air, an approach shot to the green up into the air, and he has found the heart of the green no more than 20 feet from the hole on the 11th, and that's kind of a job done because the railway line is all the way down the right-hand side. We saw Tiger Woods go into the bushes there off the tee. We saw Rory McIlroy go out of bounds onto the railway line, the ball probably ending up in London by now, or Glasgow at least. And that's really...
He's on the train to get it to London.
Yes, true. It happened a few hours ago, but still, we're looking at a scenario now of Shane Lowry having negotiated one of the toughest holes in the course, 3 under for his card. He's had a couple of par saves to back up those birdies. It's looking good, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, birdie opportunity there, really, on that hole. And those holes aren't playing as difficult as earlier in the week, with the wind having switched directions as predicted. But what I remember most about some of Larry's interviews earlier this year, and particularly at the US Open, it was really his putting was what had held him back from really high finishes. And as you say, maybe it's that it's slightly slower greens, maybe he's just found something in his stroke, but the putts he's held, is the three putts for the birdies were between 9 and 11 feet, and then that 23 footer on the 10th. And on another day you'd miss all four of those and we'd be sort of saying, oh, kind of rolling with Shane, this, that and the other, and that's made the difference.
Yeah, and I think as well that there is a sort of a body language thing with Shane, and it's really positive, and it has been positive since before these birdies were made. There's like an intent about him. I spoke to him yesterday or Tuesday on the practice round, and he was actually saying at that stage that he hadn't really got his head around the challenge here, and there's a good reason for that. The course has played really tough today. It's one of the best bunkered courses on the open rota. He said for him it was the best bunkered course, and I think he needs to know what he feels like on the tee in certain holes, because you need to be decisive. He actually said something which had an element of humour to it, but also had a strong element of truth to it. We said you can have three players standing on the tee in a three ball, and none of them knows exactly what club to take out of the bag to hit off the tee, so that you can either thread your way through the bunkers, possibly aggressively, or lay up short of them and leave yourself a longer second shot. He hadn't got that figured out on Tuesday. Clearly he has today.
You need that. With the depth of the bunkers and the shape of some of the bunkers, in some of them you're playing out sideways. You must have a clear idea what line you're hoping to start the ball. And you can say it about every course, but really here it's critical. You know your start line, you know the shape you're trying to play, you're decisive and you execute.
And basically, if you go into a bunker on the fairway in Royal Troon, there is virtually no way to the green in 95% of these bunkers. It's not like a PGA Tour where you go into a bunker and you possibly get a better lie than you get if you were in the rough. So it's a real proper test of threading the needle through these bunkers, and there are so many of them, and Shane Lowry has done that really well here, especially on the start of the back nine. Now we're looking at him standing over a putt of around 20 feet, but just while we do that, let's talk about Rory McIlroy. This was a tired looking Rory McIlroy, exasperated at times. You saw him at the US Open, Gary, where clearly he suffered the greatest disappointment of his golfing career as far as he is concerned. And Rory McIlroy has been absolutely and utterly today looking like someone who needs more than just a few weeks off.
Perhaps so, and I mean, you were here for the pre-round interviews, and I even the few other reporters I've met today were and listened to some of the previews, be the podcasts or radio or television, whatever. Not everybody was convinced that he was over the disappointment of the US Open. I think probably you feel that way. You've looked into his eyes and seen what he said, and maybe that showed up in his game today. He was level par after seven, but all bogeys and a couple of double bogeys after that. He left it in the bunker on the postage stamp, that super short par three, and then on the railway track, as you already mentioned, on the 11th, and didn't pick up any more shots, with a couple of the back nine holes playing easier than you would have expected.
And also, in contrast to the man who shot 78, Shane Lowry has just holed that putt on the 11th from around 20 feet, and he is now the outright leader of the Open on 4 under par. And now we're in a situation where it's only Thursday. We're not going to talk about daring to dream, but certainly he's put himself in position.
Well, it's very early, but he is. He couldn't be in a better position unless he was more than one shot ahead. But he is. He has made no secret of how much he would love to win this tournament.
Yeah, he said that actually in the interview I did, and we played it on Morning Ireland and Radio 1 today. He just said, "I just love one more of these." You know, is that asking too much? And it was just a beautiful human response to, you know, every time he tees it up in the Open, how much he wants to back up Royal Portrush with another win in the Open. I think would be something which would be utterly special, and matching his great pal Paddy Carrington, who won two Opens.
Yeah, it's funny because Harrington speaks about almost he'd have been disappointed with one major, and whether it was two or three, but there was a thing about only having one. That the Harrington, even now all this time later, talks about, "I didn't want to be just one, because we always, when can you win another one and there's something. And I mean, how few players have won multiple majors recently? Like, very, very few. And I'm sure maybe Larry, who hangs around the Harrington quite a bit, has got that feeling up from Harrington, and he certainly desperately wants to win another one.
So I think a tough test at Royal Troon suits the type of golfer that Shane Lowry is. He likes links golf. He likes it when it's tough. He won the Irish Open at Baltrae when the first 2 days the course played really easy, but the last 2 days the course in the wind
and rain
played so tough. So he doesn't mind. It's just so long as it's that familiar links turf, he is so at home. But also we know as well that back in the USPGA Championship just 2 months ago in May, he shot around of 62. He had a 12-foot putt in the final green, which if it had dropped, it would have been a major championship outright record. Nobody has ever shot 61 in a major championship. So this is a player with real form. He was third and fourth in the two tournaments back-to-back, the Cognizant and in the Arnold Palmer Invitational early on in the season. So now we've got a player who feels a bit of confidence coming into the Open Championship at Royal Troon, and he's in the lead on 4 under par, early stages of course. But just to go down through what else has been happening today with Irish players.
Yep.
Rory McIlroy, as we said, a round of 78. Liam Nolan's on the course, the Galway amateur. He's 2 over after 6. Tom McKibben out in the second match this morning, the fifth man out in the Open, in fact, a 2 over par round of 73. He was actually 1 under after 10, dropped 3 shots between the 11th and the 16th, but that's a tough stretch of holes, and certainly was tough this morning as the wind got up. Darren Clark, the champion in 2011, 5 over after 15, and Patrick Harrington, after starting bogey-bogey, has battled back to 1 over par after 13 holes. So the good news, Shane Lowry, the leader of the Open, on 4 under par after 11 holes, 1 stroke clear of Justin Thomas, who shot around a 68 this morning, and Xander Schauffele, the USPGA champion and a man in form this season with 11 top 10 finishes and a major championship to his name. He is tied for second place with Justin Thomas on 3 under par, Schauffele with 6 to play. The group on 2 under par, Alex Noren, Nicholas Højgaard, and Justin Rose. And just a word of the world number one, Scottie Scheffler, level par after 10, and Tiger Woods really toiling back at 6 over par in the middle of the back nine.
All right, thanks very much for the moment. That's Gary Moran and also Greg Allen there at Royal Troon. We'll have more before the end of the show from both of those. But for the moment, we're going to take a quick break.
Game on.
Football.
Welcome back to the show. John Kenny with you until 7 o'clock this evening. Rebecca Craze in the studio with us. Obviously, fingernails bitten to the quick because Shells are playing against St. Joseph's of Gibraltar. It's 1-1 still, 56 minutes into that game. So they're 2-1 up from the first leg. So 3-2 in aggregate. Very important goal from Sam Bowen there to get a levelling goal against St. Joseph's. But it's a team that should be beating, really, shouldn't they?
Yeah, I was actually out in Tolka Park when they played them in the home leg there, and you know, you could kind of tell from the start that we did look that little bit, you know, sharper and a bit more of an edge over them. You'd like to think that, look, we'll go out there and hopefully do the business now, before the end of the game.
I think they're on that plastic pitch out in Gibraltar.
Yeah. Come here, look, there's obviously 30 degrees heat or something like that is knocking around as well, so be a tough little game in the conditions, but hopefully they come true.
Yeah, and later on we'll hear from Eric White previewing the match. Derry in Europe, also playing a team, the Magpies from Gibraltar. Hopefully they can turn around that 2-0 from the first leg, which was a very disappointing result. But we were down, you and I, during the week, Rebecca, at the marvellous occasion. We talked about the under-19s in a second, but that marvellous occasion when Ireland beat France by 3-1 in the Euro qualifiers. What did you make to it all?
Yeah, it was an absolutely fantastic day. You know, it was in a great stadium. You know, I think people are a bit apprehensive given that it's Páirc Uí Chaoimh. We've never had a game there, you know, it's a GAA ground, but it seemed ideal for what it was, you know, 18,000 and odd people in the stadium, you know, really loud, really, you know, boisterous, ready for the game. Obviously, being in Denise O'Sullivan's home city as well, you know, they were out in force. The game itself, from the get-go, we were on it, you know, and I think obviously people were kind of looking and saying, look, France are putting out their lesser team, given that they did
the
Olympics.
Yeah, 11 changes.
You know, but it's still international football, you know, and there's still going to be levels, you know, above in the terms of they're number two in the world. But
look, it's not for us to decide, the Republic of Ireland to decide who they're going to face.
Exactly.
It's the French. They put the team out.
100%.
So put them out and see if you can beat them.
Yeah, and Renard on the line, he was kicking up before us, you know, from the get-go. Julianne Russell, Leanne Kiernan just were down their throats, you know, leading on the front foot, and they just couldn't deal with them. It was fantastic to see, and obviously with Julianne, I think she's the talk of the town, you know, and obviously baby Rosie being the most famous baby in mm-hmm. the country at the minute. But she's just been an absolute breath of fresh air, and I'd say people that are only kind of coming into women's football in the last 2 or 3 years are probably looking and saying, who's this Julianne Russell one, you know, new kid on the block, but she's doing this 15 years or so, you know, and she's a seasoned international, and she's been really a professional in her approach over the years. And, you know, given her last game was 2020, she went away, had the baby, you know, and she's just come back now with like a new lease of life and maybe a new reason to play the game. You know, steely determination, really tenacious. And obviously, look, she's done heavy training for marathons and things like that, but she just looks like she's 10 years younger than what she actually is. So fantastic for her. I'm delighted for her that she's done so well. 2 goals, 2 games. And it's also brilliant for the league here, you know, to have someone
sure
like herself be in there and to make such an impact.
Yeah. And the one thing I liked about the pitch as well is it seemed to fit in quite snugly onto a GAA pitch. Now, we've had men's internationals at Croke Park, and it just looked, the pitch looks absolutely
huge,
tiny
massive
stadium like that.
Yeah.
But this one's fitted nicely. There was nobody in the terrace ends at either end, the Blackrock end or the City end. But the 18,000 people in the stands made a lot of noise too, which was great.
Yeah, major amount of noise. Really, from minute one to the 99th or whatever it was, they just did not stop, you know, kids screaming and shouting, songs going around, Mexican waves even at one point. So it was absolutely fantastic.
So where do they go from here now? The one thing about the win was, or in fact a draw, in fact even a marginal defeat, would have kept them in the seeding, because they were ahead of Poland, who were below them, or stay below them now. So they've got a seeded draw, the likes of Montenegro or Greece, whatever the draw is tomorrow, so for the semi-finals. So I don't know if you've been looking about who that they like.
Yeah, I'm looking at the list there. It's Montenegro, Luxembourg, North Macedonia, Belarus, Slovenia, Romania, Albania and Greece. Look, I think, you know, you take any of them at this stage. I think Slovenia might be one of the group that might be, you know, a little bit above.
Maybe the Greeks.
And the Greeks as well. But I'd say with the way Ireland are feeling now, well, given those last 2 games, they'll be ready to take on the world, you know. So I'm interested to see how they go tomorrow.
Yeah, that draw is tomorrow anyway. But earlier on today, the Republic of Ireland, I don't know if you saw, but the Republic of Ireland were leading Germany. Mm. A huge result was on the way for the under-19s in their European championship game. They drew 0-0 with Spain in the first match, and they were leading the Germans by 1-0, but Germany showed their pedigree, I suppose, in the second half by scoring 2 quick goals to give themselves a 2-1 victory. What did you make to it?
Yeah, it was brilliant. I watched the game on TV, and it was great. You know, the goal that Leo Leary scored, it was just a snapshot. I think it was our first shot on target even. Joy Ralph done really well up top. She seems to, against Spain as well, she was, you know, making those runs in behind, getting the defence turned. Same again, she laid it off for the cross into Leah, who just took a swipe at it and caught it lovely and obviously went in. But unlucky, obviously, to come out on the losing end of it. They've been really good and put on a fantastic defensive display in the first game against Spain. Eve Dawson and Kate Thompson in centre half were, you know, walls. They just couldn't do enough throughout the whole game. And look, it's a case, obviously, Spain then today lost against Netherlands as well. So it's going to make for a very interesting game on Monday against the Netherlands. And look, hopefully.
So that's Spain with 1 point.
Yeah.
We've got one point. Germany have 4 and Spain now have 4 as well.
Netherlands now have 4.
And we have got to be the Dutch.
Basically, so hopefully, look, they did look up to it. You know, obviously the Germans shone through, but look, to be competing against the European elites like that is really, really good to see.
It's a group of death, isn't it?
Most definitely is. And again, look, I look at all those girls that are playing there. I think there's one, maybe Morin is playing out in Texas, but all those girls are products of the league. You know, they're all after coming through the ranks and, you know, through emerging talent programs, through their clubs, academy systems. You know, all them, a lot of them are playing in senior teams now with Eve Dawson and Kate Thompson, obviously at Galway, Leo Leary and Joy Ralph at Shamrock Rovers, and Aoife Kelly as well. Hannah Healy is in with Shell. So, look, they looked really, really mature in their approach. Dave Connell obviously had them set up really well. Again, really tenacious in their approach to each game so far. And hopefully they can maybe get it over the line against the Dutch.
Yeah, it's a big ask. But as I say, it's a very, very tough group. The one thing, you know, just to refer back to the 18,000 people that turned up at Páirc Uí Chaoimh on Tuesday, last time the French played against Ireland in Cork, Turner's Cross, something like 827 people at it. It just shows the difference. And also in German football as well, there's anecdotal evidence that the men, who are obviously a very disappointing Euros, are getting lesser crowds than the women are getting. So time may be turning for you gals.
Yeah, look, I think women's football is on the up. It has been in the last few years. I think it's time for people to believe in it and invest in it, especially here at home in Air League. You know, as I said, it's so fantastic to see someone from the league here like Julianne, who's come through, you know, at P-Mount even, obviously went off to Australia for a bit, but she's a product of here. The majority of those girls that are playing in that, you know, in that squad, Denise's, Katie's, Louise Quinn, are coming from our league here. And as you say, all across Europe, the women's game is on the, you know, the upward trajectory, and it, more of the same. Hopefully now in the next 5-6 years, you know, we might see even more crowds. We might double that again. But it is just a case of people believing in it and investing in it and look, taking a leap of faith with it.
Sure, and winning is obviously very important.
Yes.
You know, by winning games, it attracts more people to matches, of course.
Yeah, of course. And look, it all comes from the grassroots up. You know, we need facilities. We need all that kind of, you know, emphasis on having the best of it at international level, you know, to go and compete against these great nations across Europe and obviously hopefully the world then, you know, when we hopefully make those bigger tournaments. But it has to be at home here. It has to be grassroots stuff. It has to be the facilities, you know, improving. And people just putting their time and effort into it here. We have great volunteers throughout the country, but it's time for the likes of the association to dig deep for us.
Okay, before I let you go, it's still 1-1, St. Joseph's and Shelburne.
Yes.
So time is ticking by nicely. I'm a Shells man too.
Oh,
so,
okay, good.
65 minutes, we won't. So Shells are 3-2 up on aggregate. The other game we mentioned earlier on, a 7:45 start tonight. It's the Magpies of Gibraltar coming in to play against Derry City. They're 2-0 down from the first leg, Derry City. Eric White reports.
If Derry City are to progress, they must do what no Irish side has done before in European competition, and that's overturn a 2-0 first leg defeat. After last week's shock result in Gibraltar, when City conceded 2 second-half goals, both from set pieces, manager Ruairi Higgins remains optimistic they can turn it around, even if they have to be patient in doing so. They did win all 3 home legs in Europe last season. For Bruno's Magpies, this is only their third time to qualify for Europe. The part-timers lost to Dundalk and Irish League side Crusaders in each of the last 2 seasons. This is the biggest night in their short history. A huge prize awaits in the second round, with the winners to face FC Copenhagen. Kick-off at the Brandywell is at 7:45.
And welcome back to Game On. It's just gone 6:30 in the evening. John Kenny with you on Game On this Thursday evening. And good evening to Andrew Balbirnie. Andy, how are you doing, mate?
Very good, John. How are you?
Very good. Andrew Balbirnie is he was the former Irish cricket captain for the white ball game, the 50 and the 20 over version, but he's given up that role, but he retains the test match captaincy. And next week, Ireland are playing against Zimbabwe in Stormont, the first time Ireland will have played a game in Belfast in a test arena. Last time Ireland played in the test arena, they beat Afghanistan, first win in 8 matches, and the first time they played in Ireland was against Pakistan back in 2018. That's the history. Looking forward, Andrew, to next week against Zimbabwe, a team that you know well.
Yeah, it is a team we know pretty well. We've played a lot of white ball cricket against them over the last kind of 3 or 4 years, both in Zimbabwe and up here in Ireland, Belfast and Dublin. So first time running out against them in test cricket, so it'll have a different challenge, but the same sort of personnel. They'll know us fairly well, and the skill set we have, similar to us will know what they can do and how dangerous they can be. So hopefully should be a great kind of week's cricket.
Yeah, and hopefully you get the weather as well. Stormont, it's a good ground. It's a wide, big, wide open spaces. But we're hearing anecdotally that they don't have the money to build up stands because most of those stands are going to Paris for the Olympics. So it would cost them three times the amount. So anyone there will be sitting in, on fold-out chairs. But they're expecting crowds of around 1,200 a day, which isn't bad.
Yeah, that'd be great. You know, I think the Olympics probably takes precedence over a test match in against Zimbabwe at the moment, but look, we're really looking forward to getting up there and playing the kind of first test match in Belfast. I think we played our first ever ODI there in 2006 against England, so it's kind of poignant that we're back there to play our first test match. So yeah, I think whatever crowd we get in, we'll want to entertain them and give them their money's worth.
Yeah, we know that a test match is a five-day game. It's the ultimate test, isn't it? That's why they call it a test match. But you're coming off the back of a disappointing T20 World Cup, but it's a completely different structure, it's a completely different game, and the patience and the mindset is completely different as well, isn't it?
It is, yeah. Look, we've had a lot of one-day cricket in the last sort of... Well, ever since I started playing, it's been one-day cricket, whether 50-over T20 cricket. We get a lot of it all around the world, and test cricket, you know, we naturally haven't played a lot. I think this will be our ninth test match. Mm-hmm. But yeah, like you said, the T20 World Cup was a huge disappointment, but also one that we kind of swept under the carpet pretty quickly. I think it was kind of a tournament to forget for us as cricketers. And when you have things like that happen to you, you just want to get straight back playing. And these sort of 5 days give us that opportunity to hopefully get back to winning ways, but more importantly, just to play good cricket. We know that, you know, test cricket these days, it doesn't tend to go all the way to 5 days, but whatever the outcome, we'll be looking to try to get that win.
Yeah, hopefully the Belfast weather is going to play ball. That's the most important thing, I think, from your point of view.
Yeah, very important.
To get the days in as well. You announced a 14-man squad. Happy enough with what you've got?
Yeah, really happy. There's a great kind of mix of pace bowlers and spin bowlers. Gavin Howie is the kind of name that stands out. He's in his first Irish squad, so really excited for him and his family. Matthew Humphreys is the other young spinner who played for us in the subcontinent last year, and he's come back with really good form. So a really fit squad at the moment, no injuries, which is great, and always easier for a captain when it comes down to select. Well, I mean, it's never easy, but it's nice to pick from a fully fit squad. So look, there'll be disappointed guys next week, unfortunately, but I'm sure whatever 11 we put out will be strong enough to hopefully give Zimbabwe a good game.
And that's the thing, isn't it, Andy? You know, you're one of the selectors as well, being captain, that you've got 14 players and three miss out, which is terrible. They become water carriers in the end. But, I mean, it's still part of the squad, obviously, and obviously looking down the line to play different games down and over the next couple of years as well. But this is a major disappointment when you're left out, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. And, you know, I've been left out of squads myself and teams. It's the hardest part of the job is kind of telling those guys the night before that they're not going to play a big game for Ireland. But that's part of the sport and part of any sport, I suppose. You have that disappointment. But what we try to instill in the group is that there are so many opportunities now that there will be chances in the future to prove me wrong and to prove the selectors wrong when it comes down to the 11. But look, naturally, there are going to be three disappointed guys this time next week, but hopefully they can still add value to the squad over match days and see how we go.
You had a recent four-day game, a red ball game, didn't you, between basically an inter-squad in Malahide. Some runs for Paul Sterling, which he needed. He got about 90, I think. Harry Tector, though, maybe a little concerned he's not amongst the runs, and he certainly is a top-class player. You know, form is temporary, as I say, class is permanent, and hopefully he can come good in Belfast.
Yeah, I don't really have too many doubts about Harry. He's a really special talent that we have in Ireland, and we're very lucky to have him. You know, batting is very tough at times, and you have, you know, bad days more than you have good, but he's the sort of character that will bounce back very quickly. I know that he loves test match cricket and the challenge of that and batting for long periods of time. So, look, all of us batters want to be in form, but sometimes you won't find that, but it might just take one innings to get that, and hopefully a number of our guys can kind of find that form next week.
Yeah, and we saw when you played England a couple of times in the Test Match Arena at Lord's just how much of an appetite there was for Test cricket amongst the Irish Test-watching nation. So hopefully they'll get the good backing as well there. Have you got television sorted all? Is that all sorted out now as well? You get a chance to show Ireland to the world?
I hope so, yeah. I mean, I obviously don't get involved in that sort of stuff, but every time we play, it's an advertisement for our sport. And, you know, sometimes we play good cricket and people want to watch us and come and watch us. And, you know, sometimes it doesn't go like that. But I think it's very important that our guys can showcase their skills to as many people as possible. I know Zimbabwe are very passionate about their cricket as well. So there'll be a lot of people down there watching this test with interest. But yeah, I think the guys, whether we're on telly or we're not on telly, we go over that white line with the same sort of attitude. And that's to try to win games and do our very best to win games without performance. So that'll be no different.
Sure. And final question, I suppose, Zimbabwe are pretty much on the same level as you, would you think? So it's going to be tight, close game?
I think so, yeah. Like I said at the start, we kind of know each other pretty well, and it's the same sort of names that pop up when we play each other. I don't think they've played a test match for a year and a half now. So, they're similar to us in the sense that we don't get a whole lot of test cricket compared to the big nations, but they have some very experienced players in their ranks, and they'll definitely be coming over here. You know, we beat them in a T20 series and a one-day series just before Christmas down in Harare. So I've no doubt that they'll be coming over here to try to turn us over.
OK, we wish you the very best of luck with that. That's Andrew Balbirnie, the Irish cricket captain, the Test cricket captain, Ireland against Zimbabwe, Stormont in Belfast this day week. We wish the boys the very best of luck over the 5 days of competition. We'll be getting ready, as mentioned there, for Paris. We're going to be hearing from Mona McSharry, who made the final of the 100 metres breaststroke 3 years ago in Tokyo. She's in confirmed for the 100 and the 200 metres breaststroke and the relay this time, and we'll be hearing from her after this break.
Game on 2FM.
Shane Larry continues to lead at the Open Golf Championship in Royal Troon. He's 4 under par after 12 holes. He's got a one shot lead now from Justin Thomas, and a bad day unfortunately for Rory McIlroy, which more anon before the end of the show. Now I'll be at my 8th Olympic Games this week. Thankfully, I'm being selected once again to commentate on the swimming and the aquatic events at the Paris Olympics. I'm really looking forward to it. Hopefully, you can join us, myself and Nick O'Hare, for the heats and finals throughout the competition, which starts on Saturday week. Now, earlier this week, I caught up with breaststroke specialist Mona McSharry. She made the final of the 100 metres breaststroke in Tokyo a couple of years ago, and I've been talking to her about how she feels and is she ready for the Paris Olympics. Mona, for you, this is the second Olympic Games. Tokyo is obviously a pretty good one for you. Can you go even further this time around?
I mean, I think that's definitely the plan, is always to do better than I have before, and so we'll just have to see how it goes. I've been training hard, and that's really all I can ask of myself, so now I'm just going to go out and have fun and see what happens.
100 obviously was the main one, but congratulations on now getting into the 200, and you have a relay as well, so, you know, it's going to be a busy time, isn't it? I mean, they're the events which are the shorter ones, the ones, the 200s, and the relays obviously is a straight final, but you're going to have to work yourself through the rounds, haven't you? And that's not that easy.
It's definitely not easy, but I think it's something that I've done quite a lot now, so it seems like a normal meet for me. It'd honestly be probably stranger if I only had, you know, one race. So it's nice. It's spread out pretty well. I'll be racing throughout the course of swimming at the Olympics, which will be fun. And topping it off with a relay is always nice, so I can get up with the girls and just have some fun, and kind of whatever happens, happens.
Well, the Olympics doesn't hold any fears for you anymore. I mean, like, first time of the Games, you'd be in the call room, and, you know, this whole week or two before the Games as well, but the nerves will set in as well. How are you? How are those kind of nerves?
I think I've had some benefits in kind of staying away from Ireland and training in Tennessee. That helps to kind of be a little bit disconnected from the buzz, which is good. Don't want to have that too early. And even being in Dublin, which is a familiar place, I've stayed at the Crown Plaza before and, you know, trained in the National Centre. I think that definitely helps to calm some nerves. But honestly, I'm feeling confident and just excited. I've been to so many competitions where I think I've let nerves get the better of me, and that's not, you know, I just want to have fun. It's probably going to be my last Olympics, so I want to soak up every moment.
Oh, even before the Olympics, you're saying this could be your last one. Is that what you're thinking? I mean, it's a very difficult sport to keep going, isn't it, for another couple of years, thinking another 4 years in mind, but this could be your last one.
Yeah, there's a slim chance that I say I'm going to go to 2024, 2028. it was always 2024 was going to be my year, and so I've never really thought about that. And I think I don't think I could do another 4 years. I just want to live life, you know.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, this is further down the line. This is obviously the main priority is the 1-200 and that relay as well. Just tell us a little bit about the relay as well. Are you excited to be part of a squad at the Olympic Games for Ireland?
Oh, yeah, definitely. I think a lot of my training in Tennessee is, you know, racing for a team and being on a lot of relays. So I have a lot of, you know, experience with that. And I think it's fun to be able to, you know, be on a team with girls. And we haven't done that before. We haven't qualified a relay in a long time. So it's going to be great.
So the 100's first. Ease yourself through the rounds. Get yourself through in that pool early in the first couple of days of competition. What's the thinking?
Just like you said, make it through the rounds, you know, focus on one thing at a time. We're thinking about the heats right now, and then when I earn my spot in the semis, I'll be focusing on that, and then same for the final. And you know, once you get into the final, it's one against eight, and you just see who gets their hands on the wall first, and everyone has an equal opportunity. So that's what I'm looking forward to, is to get myself in a position where I can really just race, because that's what the sport's about. It's just racing.
Yeah, 100 breaststroke has been your main event over the years, hasn't it? Because it's the one where you went at 17 years of age, you won the Youth Olympics, last Olympics, you qualified for the final as well. But the 200 suddenly popped up. It wasn't something that you were too enthused about in the past, but obviously you're much more enthused about it now that you've made the qualifying time.
Yeah, I mean, I think I've said this time and time again, but it's a harder race because it's not a sprint, and it clicked in Canada and went in 2:22, which is way faster than anything I've ever been able to produce before, and it felt amazing. So I mean, I think just trying to hold on to that feel and the way that I swam it and be able to do that again at the Olympics, and I'll have a good shot of, you know, making a semi and maybe a final in that event too, which would be amazing.
Yeah, 200 breaststroke, it's, you know, got to keep the stroke long, don't spin in the water. It's a lot, very technical sport, come say the 100, which is, as you say, a bit of a sprint as well. So you turn it on 100, is still a long way to go, isn't it? But you've got to keep that mentality, and it's a very mentally draining discipline, I hear, because I heard down the years, like Gary O'Toole, Andrew Bree, we've got a good pedigree in swimming, especially in the 200 breaststroke.
Yeah, definitely. I think there's so many different ways you can race it, and it's sometimes you get pulled away with the people that are beside you, and so it's just about, you know, being confident in the way that you swim in your race and knowing that, like, okay, if they're ahead, I'm going to be able to catch them, or like, if I'm ahead, am I going too fast? No, I'm doing what I'm doing. So I think it's all about that, and then just the mental game of knowing that it's going to hurt, and it's going to hurt for a little longer than the 100 hurts. But look, when I swim it well, you get so much enjoyment just out of completing that race well, because it is a little bit longer and more challenging. So I'm just going to sit on that side of it, and hopefully it'll come together.
Breaststroke is a very technical sport, or a technical discipline. 12 Irish athletes going from Swim Ireland as well. Got a couple of divers there as well. It's great to have a big squad, isn't it?
Oh yeah, I mean, I said it going to the last Olympics, it's going to be great to have such a big team, and now even bigger team and more women going, which is always great. So I think it's nice, you bring a good Irish camaraderie, and like, everyone can get excited for each other, and there's always just more of a buzz when you have more people there, and you're more invested in people's races and what they're doing, and so I think it's going to be great.
Daniel seems confident he's going to bring home a medal. Are you?
Hey, we'll see what happens. It's definitely a goal of mine, and so I'm going to be racing for it against some of the best women in the world, so I can only be proud of what I come back with.
Yeah. It's nearly a home Olympics as well in Paris. Will you have family there?
Yeah, I feel like it's all the extended family and friends and all going, so it'll be great. I have a big support squad going. Yeah,
scramble for tickets?
They were actually very organised, so yeah, no scrambling.
And coming from a small little club like the Marlin Swimming Club to now be on the international and world stage as well, what's the feeling like? I know you were home for a couple of days. What are they feeling about before you come to participating in the games again?
Everyone's just so excited, so buzzed. For the 48 hours I was at home, I seen flags and people wishing me good luck and all very excited. And, you know, it's just great to have that support. And I know it's there, but to be able to go home and actually experience it in person is always nice.
One question about the recent doping scandals, the 23 Chinese swimmers. You know, some did win medals while you were swimming in Tokyo. What's your view on that, and what's been handled by WADA and the world governing bodies?
I honestly haven't paid much attention to it. I haven't done a lot of research on it. It's kind of out of my control. It's definitely very upsetting to hear that things like that are going on, and that, you know, positive tests are being swept under the rug, and I don't love to hear about it, and you want it to be, you know, clean sport for everybody, but I just try not to focus on it because it's not something that I can really control.
Yeah, we obviously would be disappointed to hear that if somebody who do beat you is one of those that maybe somewhere down the line tests positive. I mean, we saw it from London that it turned out one of the dirtiest games of all time, but that just came down the line. So obviously you just got to focus on the now and the immediate, and then let that supposed kind of stuff take care of itself.
Yeah, exactly. You know, you just hope that, like, when something is brought to light like that, that hopefully it doesn't happen again, or they'll be a little bit stricter, and, you know, yeah, I just focus on myself, make sure that I'm doing all the right things, and then hopefully no one else is cheating around me.
Game on 2FM. That's always the big hope, is hopefully nobody's cheating around her. That's Mona McSherry there. And sticking with the Paris preparations, RT Sports' Michael Glennon has been catching up with Stacey Flood as the Irish Seven side are ready for Olympic action as well.
What's your workload like building up to it now? You had the tournament in Hamburg. It probably didn't go as well as you wanted. But what has the workload been like building up to this point now, and what's going to be like in the next week?
Yeah, I think Hamburg was actually a pretty good eye-opener for us. Just obviously we came off the back of a long season on the World Series, and the teams kind of changed throughout the year, which was really good for our squad to grow. So Hamburg was probably a good restart for us, and then to lead back into training. And we're in tours now, pre-camp, pre-Olympics, where the men's 15s were based, exact same setup for us.
We were there. I miss it terribly. It's a lovely place.
It is a lovely place. We're only here 2 days. This is our third day, so we're really enjoying it at the minute. And the training facilities are top quality, so we've been training away, fixing, righting some wrongs that did go wrong in Hamburg. But we're building our confidence back up, and we're going to really focus on this pre-tournament training camp, and hopefully we get our intensity up and we keep driving on like we're driving on, because it's been going well. And we train against the USA girls tomorrow here, which should be a good battle for us, which we're looking forward to. So yeah, hopefully we just keep building in how we are, because it has been going well. And I think tours was just a little bit of a hiccup, but it did show us what we needed to work on and gave us that like little bit of a kick. Yeah, and we aren't too worried about it, because sometimes you need that. And when you are flying high or in mode of like ebbs and flows, like you just need to be coming back up then. So yeah, it's been going well.
Good stuff. And do you do any crossover training with the guys, or are you totally separate? I know sometimes before the 15s would take on some men's teams or youth teams. Have you done any training with the sevens team? Because I guess you're in the same camp a lot.
Yeah, so obviously the boys have similar training schedules to us. They might be an hour before us or an hour after us, training-wise. But we do train against them maybe once a month, or once every few weeks. We might do a bit of training against them this week if it aligns. We did train against our under 18s boys recently as well. So yeah, we do get hit out against the lads. Chasing them is pretty fun. As you can imagine, you're picking the fastest rugby players. It is good, but it does show you if your defensive shape is good and if you're defending alone or as a line. So, it is really good. And when something comes off against them, it's a good pat on the back, because, you know, it'll come off against any other team as well, with the boys finishing second on the series overall.
Yeah. Just about Vicky Waugh not making the squad, because when she joined, it was a bit of publicity. She did a bit of media, and it was kind of a big deal. And she said herself it was all about getting to the Olympics. Why can you understand, or Mia, how close was she from what you could see of getting up to the standard? And did it say something that she wasn't picked just for the sake of it, because of to open up the pathway more to more Gaelic footballers coming in?
Oh, look, Vicky's added massive value to the programme on and off the field. And I think for someone to make that change, and make that change so publicly to a new sport, is so brave. And she's been extremely inquisitive this year and trying to learn the game, and like it's been incredible to watch her and see how she trains and how she conducts herself. And how she's switched over to being a rugby player, because that's what she is. She is an amazing rugby player, and I think if she had another few months, like, I'd back her all the way, because she has come on leaps and bounds. Like, for someone who had never picked up a rugby ball, I don't think many people would put themselves out there like that, and I commend her so much, and she's been a great teammate. So no, fair play to her giving it a go, and she's added massive value to the team and to training. So hopefully she stays around now, and we can see her in the next Olympic cycle and on the series next year, because I think she is one to watch.
No, that'd be great. All right. Just looking ahead to the Olympics and the pool, you have Great Britain, South Africa and Australia. I mean, you obviously play these teams all across the year. Do you come up with specific game plans for specific teams, or is just everything happening so fast that you can only focus on yourself and make sure you make the most of the ball when you have it?
Well, where do you come up for specific questions for specific people? Because I think you do. I think teams play differently, and you can have a few moves here and there that are different for teams to exploit how they defend. And I think once you play how you want to play and your basis, and we have a certain style. So if we stick to that, and then on our set pieces, kind of play against them to exploit their defensive not weaknesses but opportunities, it's really good. So yeah, we do come up with different kind of moves and game plans for different people, but yeah. The basis is sticking to how we play and how we want to put our game plan and implement what we want to do over theirs. Yeah.
And Perth showed what you can do as well. So, I mean, you can't shy away from, I guess the goal is to get on the podium.
Yeah, look, I think focusing in on having a good training week this week and focusing in on what we need to work on and how we're going to be best prepared going into the games and trying to get those performances is the most important thing, and not to get ahead of ourselves or to look too far ahead. Like, obviously, Perth does give us that confidence to be going and performing against teams, and I think that is important to know that we have that in us, but also not to get carried away about where we want to end up, because if you don't focus on the now, you'll just not be present and not be able to get those performances. So I think that's more important as a lead in anyway.
That's Stacey Flood there with her own Michael Glennon from RTE Sports, the Irish women's seven side. In Olympic action, they face Great Britain on Sunday week, the 23rd of July, with a 2:30 kickoff Irish time. St. Joseph's won, Shelburne won. They're into added time in the end of that game. Shelburne still leading by 2-1 in the Europa Conference League. Hopefully they'll have the result of that before the end of the show. But let's get back to the boys in Royal Troon. Is Shane Lowry still leading, lads?
He is, and he's on 4 under par, and he's just negotiated the 13th safely. No issues there whatsoever. He has had 4 birdies, no drop shots. He's just playing the par 3 14th, and he's headed to the back of the green, just off the edge, but only in light grass and not much more than 25, 30 feet away. It has been a great day for Shane Lowry, but the rest of the Irish, Gary, today, I mean, clearly Rory McIlroy 78. Howard, just go through, I suppose, what we've got for the other five players.
Okay, well, we've got Padraig Harrington, who is tied 34th, which is decent enough. He's 1 over par through 16 holes. It's been pretty steady from him. We have Tom McKibben. He was out very, very early, 6:45 off time. Such a long day here. 2 over par finished. Wasn't that happy. I mean, you spoke to him. He wasn't that happy with his ball striking. Said he didn't really have it under control. Looking for better tomorrow. Looking to maybe shoot level par. But he's finished on 2 over, 73. We've got Liam Nolan, the amateur from Galway, pre-qualifier. 3 over after 10. Now, back nine playing a little easier than the front nine. Perhaps it is longer, all right, and a lower par. But just the way the wind was, maybe if he can hold around that, I'd say he'd be fairly happy with that. And then we've got Darren Clark, 6 over playing the last. And of course, Rory McIlroy, who we've spoken about, really a very, very bad day for him. There's no other way of saying it, 7 over par.
Yeah, and obviously Rory McIlroy, after his US Open experience, with a decent Scottish Open last week where he finished top 10, just not really looking as though this was a challenge that he needed in his season after what happened to him in the US Open. It was a tough day. There was a lot of exasperation in his expression. But on the 14th, just off the back of the 14th, Shane Lowry is going to putt in a moment. And this is obviously a chance to go to 5 under par. And Shane Lowry has just, been a very good effort to make that birdie there. So Shane Lowry is going to stay at 4 under par. The ball is rested within 3 or 4 inches from the hole. That will be a tap in, and Lowry will remain at 4 under par. One stroke clear of Justin Thomas, alone in second place on 3 under par after a 68. The group on 2 under par includes Xander Schauffele, who was in the group tied with Justin Thomas, or just tied with Justin Thomas at 3 under par. But Schauffele, the US PGA champion, dropped a shot on the 14th. He's now playing the 16th, and Schauffele very much in the mix, along with Nicklas Højgaard, Alex Noren, Justin Rose, and Russell Henley, and they are all on 2 under par. And it's Lowry leading by 1 with 4 holes to play in this first round, 1 stroke clear of Justin Thomas.
Thanks very much to Greg Allen and to Gary Moran there at Royal Troon. They're actually still playing in that Shelbourne game. They're 7-8 minutes into added time now. Sean Gannon's been sent off for Shells. They're hanging on. It's St. Joseph's 1, Shelbourne 1. Shells are 3-2 up on aggregate, and hopefully they can hang on in the last few minutes. I'm John Kenny. Hope you enjoyed the presentation today of Game On. Graeme Smith is next.